Hey, from Team Hysterical. Did you know we should be pooping every day? Every day. Can you imagine? Yesterday, we chatted with Dr. Fionnuala McHale, a functional medicine clinician and gut health expert. The importance of a healthy microbiome can't be overstated, and Dr. McHale goes deep into what helps create a healthy gut, how to maintain one in both kids and adults, and offers some hot tips on how to get on the right track. Also, great news. We're all going to do a gut health test with Genova and reconnect with Dr. Fionnuala to better understand our results and get to the bottom of our GI symptoms. Enjoy this chat.
Welcome, Hysterical community. This is Amanda, one of the founders of Hysterical. It's really nice to be with you here today and with Dr. Fionnuala McHale for our conversation around the gut and, as we've so aptly called it, getting our shit together. Dr. McHale Fionnuala, she studied medicine at the medicine at the Trinity College of Dublin with research posts at the University of Ulster Regenerative Medicine Institute in Galway, the University of Miami, and the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Her passion lies in healthcare, how to achieve, maintain, and ultimately optimize existing health as a positive entity than rather simply the absence of disease. Hear, hear. I'm all here for that. That's what we're all here for. And Dr. Fionnuala is now a functional medicine doctor and has a lot of experience in the gut and a lot of the different body systems related to that. So without further ado, we're going to dive right in. Welcome.
Thank you, Amanda, for that very kind introduction.
Oh, it's so nice to have you here. You know, when we were chatting before, and what I want our audience to know, because some of, you know, we have a very global audience and people might not know how well known you are in the UK and how well regarded you are in Ireland. But when we first spoke on the pre-chat, it was very clear that you have this encyclopedic knowledge of not only the gut, but all the body systems that sort of are extended from there. So like, how did you get to this point? Because we're now hearing about the gut, like quite a lot, you know, sort of in the general press and science narratives, but you've been in this work for what, something like 20 years or something remarkable?
Well,
like
maybe well, not no, like, well, 13 at this stage.
Longer than we've been hearing about it. So how did you get here much earlier than all the rest of us?
I guess a study of medicine. We spoke about this maybe before in terms of how I got into functional medicine space in the first place. So that's maybe a good place to start. So in studying medicine, I ended up with a lot of health issues myself and found myself at the point, let's say, what, 21 years old, probably younger, with a whole host of medications for a variety of complaints, from like skin complaints like acne, severe nodular cystic acne, tummy complaints as well. Like I always had pain in the abdomen. I was repeatedly told that I was making it up or it was all in my head. Which on some level was true, but not quite in the way that it was intended. Irregular periods. In fact, I had absent periods. And so all of these health issues, and then, you know, you're studying medicine and you kind of get to a point where you're like, okay, I'm this age and I have all of these medications. This really isn't making sense to me, especially because I did have such a strong like biochemistry background. Like I did a lot of research when I was younger. So I was always into the molecular side of things and it just really didn't seem to make any sense. So I kind of went down a different route and started to look at strength and conditioning. And long story short, ended up coming across functional medicine, which I absolutely loved because it was so molecular, biochemistry based, diagnostics focused, and ultimately looking at the person as an individual and as a whole, as opposed to just, this is my symptom, what medication am I going to use to treat it? So that really, on one hand, like I loved studying it. And then on the second side of things, started to use some of those tools to help myself, got off all the medication. And if anything, started to feel like the best I'd ever felt, bearing in mind that I came from like a competitive athletic background as well. And so with that in mind, I kind of made up my mind at that point that once I had finished like my training in the hospital and all the rest, I was going to pursue functional medicine. So I was kind of like studying that in the background while I was doing my medical degree as well. So then I suppose you get into practice and you start to see people who are not only sick with very physical complaints that they can denote very easily, like, oh, I have this problem and that problem, whatever else, but you're also kind of listening to the person and listening to their history, and to them, their psychological history as well as the physical symptoms. And I suppose over the years of testing and everything else, I suppose what really stood out to me was the role of the gut. So although maybe the research was in its infancy, like, I was starting to see that, yeah, okay, I can do this test, and there's some research there that kind of supports what I'm doing, but it was kind of happening by accident, to be honest. I think many of these things come up by accident, but you start to see that when you're using these tools to manipulate maybe variables on a stool test, that not only were the people coming back reporting improvements in their gut symptoms, but all of these other things were starting to improve. So their energy levels were starting to improve. The skin was starting to improve. Women were starting to notice less troublesome periods. So I suppose it was over the years of doing a lot of testing, initially repeat testing, seeing, I suppose, objective biomarkers of improvement alongside the symptomatic side of things as well. So, and then, like I said, the research has come out and done nothing but really, I suppose, supported the role of the gut, and I suppose given us a better idea of how these things are doing what they're doing. So we have a lot more research on, you know, the different categories of bacteria within the gut, their role, and if anything, I think it's only growing, which is excellent to see. The diagnostics have come a long way as well, insofar as you used to only really have the microbiology side of things. Now we're using PCR technology to identify pathogenic microorganisms in particular. So that's maybe
a long. It's so good. It's so good. Some of our friends who are not familiar with the lilting, wonderful cadence of the Irish accent might listen to the 1.25 speed, or no, 0.75 speed, but that's the wonderful technology. No, you're absolutely perfect. On track. Well, I want to start here because I think there's like something weird in the world, you know, that probably starts with competition, but why is functional medicine, it's medicine, but why is that different than traditional medicine? And how do we hold those two things? Because you're a doctor, you went to medical school, but why do we hold, like, why is there a disclaimer related to functional medicine? I want to understand that a little bit more, because it certainly sounds very intuitive and proactive. And, you know, especially in the West, we have this very reactive approach to medicine. And I wonder why we're so attached to that. You know, it seems such a lost leader, and we're certainly in this place in the world where that's not really working anymore. So why is there a stigma? I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is in Ireland. I don't know about the US, but absolutely in Ireland. And I suppose it's like anything, people are sometimes afraid of what they don't know. And look, I suppose the traditional side of things, a conventional model is very simple. And certainly as the world has become far more litigious, like, bearing that in mind as well, like, things have to be very, like, you have to be careful what you say, because, you know, am I going to be in trouble over this, X, Y, and Z? So those things have become more problem, or probably always been there. But when you're trying to do something different, it's always going to be a problem. And like I said, it's a lot easier for anybody to say, okay, well, let's say take depression, for example. Patient comes in, I tick, tick, tick the box of, they fit into this category. And then I go to my list and I say, okay, this is the first line antidepressant, so I'm going to try that. That doesn't work. I'm going to go to the thing and see what's the increase the dose and so on. It's very easy. And there's a lot more work involved, like, in functional medicine, because there's certain things that you can't ever quantify, because you're also factoring in the role of psychology as well as the physiological symptoms. So with functional medicine, you're looking at the patient as a whole, not just individual system. So you're not just looking at the cardiovascular system, you're not just looking at the GI symptom as a system, and you're also looking at more chronic complaints as opposed to, like, acute concerns. So, like, say, for example, what is the most standard GI diagnostic test in the conventional side of thing? You're looking at a colonoscopy. So, like, that's only really a camera that's going up the back passage, or the other side as well, going down from the mouth, to look inside the gut to see, are there any tumors, are there any polyps, are there any ulcers? These are all acute things that need to be addressed, rather than, you know, like, stuff that I'd be looking at is microbial issues that the patient may not be acutely sick, but that doesn't mean it's not causing a low level problem that they don't need to be in hospital for. Sure, but sure. At the present moment, might be causing a low-grade problem, but also addressing that at that time is preventive for more things that will accumulate as a result of that imbalance, whatever it happens to be. I suppose I'm just sticking to largely the gut side of things. But again, hope that's not a long-winded answer to
No, no, it's not. And it's not the absence of medicine or interventions that come in pill form, right? It's just not that as the first option. Is that right?
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong, like, I still use pharmaceutical medications, but that you're looking at all of the different tools in your toolkit, and you're also looking at, like, is there anything I can do prior to trying the medication? Sure. Or, for example, in psychiatry, where, yeah, you know, like, the gut has such a huge role to play in terms of mood. Like, the patient may be so acute that, yeah, they need to be on medication to stabilize them down so they can engage in therapy and so that they can start to engage in the lifestyle too. So if someone's very depressed, it's very difficult to ask them to get up and go in the shower, brush their teeth, never mind go out for a walk or do resistance training 3 times a week. So, like, it's a combination of those things that we want to look at and to be aware of all of the different things that we can use together and the timeline of those interventions. So if we look at, let's say, when we're going to be talking about menopause and perimenopause and the role of the gut, can I address the gut side of things in early perimenopause such that when it comes to menopause, I'm not going to have such distressing symptoms at that time, rather than I'll just wing it and, you know, I'll just get a prescription then when it comes to the time.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's address the gut, because this is where we all are in time and place. And what you said, a couple of really poignant things just now that I don't want to lose. One, the mood is so affected by the gut, so we'll dig into that. But then this very casual, you know, if you're so depressed, you can't walk or resistance train. And you know, we always want our community to know that moving your body and resistance training are things that we need to be doing for our mental health as much as our physical health. So it's just worth, you know, sort of underscoring that. So the mood is, like, really connected to the gut. And how a lot of stuff that is happening in perimenopause feels, a disorder is not the right word, but it feels very tenuous from a mood perspective, right? Like, how am I holding or being able to deal with my life on any given day? And the analogy I always use is, you know, it's your ceiling, you know, so what are you doing to raise your ceiling, you know, on any given day, so that if something stressful happens and you jump, you're not hitting your head against the ceiling, right? But in perimenopause, you know, there are all these different things that are happening with our body system that are just continues to lower our ceiling. So tell us what you know about that, because it would be great to get in front of it. And I know our audience is really looking for that proactive approach.
Yeah, so I suppose the gut is such a big part of preparing for the menopause for a variety of reasons. So I'm sure everybody listening is aware of all of the potential complications that can result from the decline in the hormones. And so if we look at the gut and what it does first, might be a good way of maybe leading into it. So we know that the gut has so many, it's such a huge role to play in so many factors of human health. So for one, like the big role of the gut in terms of estrogen metabolism, estrogen being one of those female sex hormones that starts to decline as we age, you know, not just in the menopause, it's gradually declining. And so we have this subset of bacteria called the estrogen. So those bacteria in the gut that are capable of affecting estrogen metabolism, which applies not only in the perimenopause, menopause period, but also earlier in your menstrual history. So period complaints, heavy bleeding, infertility, all of these, we will still be looking at the gut and seeing is there anything going on there. The gut also has a huge role to play in inflammation, which we know on the immune system. And we know where, as we approach the perimenopause, menopause period, we're more susceptible to autoimmune conditions by virtue of the decline in the hormones alone, not to mention if we had a dysbiosis in and of itself, that would have a role to play there. So there's two factors at play. And also, as I said, the role of the gut in terms of how it affects the brain, not just in terms of mood. So oftentimes when we talk about the gut brain axis, people are talking about gut, like our mood, am I depressed? Am I anxious? Am I more susceptible to the symptoms of stress? I'm forgetting, I suppose, things like brain fog, like, you know, yep. feeling very slow mental processing, feeling like I'm going to speak a word. I know what the word is, but it's stuck at the back of my head. I can't quite bring it to the front. And energy. So energy really for most people is down to disruption within those brain biochemicals, as opposed to I haven't eaten enough food, or I've eaten too much food, or I haven't exercised enough, or I've exercised too much. For most cases of poor energy, poor endurance, mental endurance, a lot of that does come down to what's going on within the brain biochemistry, which can be affected by what's going on at the gut for two reasons. Those bugs have a role to play in neurotransmitter metabolism directly, and the food that we eat as a result. But it also going to have an impact on the inflammation. Inflammation in the gut is going to cause inflammation in the brain, and more susceptible to things like brain fog and depression in particular.
Okay, I'm going to pause you for 1 second because there's a lot here. So we need a lot of bugs in our gut to help process all of the different systems. And there's a lot of different systems that are related to the gut and how well it's doing that. We've heard a lot, you know, in our various talks about inflammation, and we even heard it from a neuroscientist who's like, I know inflammation leads to Alzheimer's. I couldn't tell you what inflammation is or what you should do about it. I'm a leading neuroscientist, all the way to an OBGYN who, you know, uses inflammation sort of and the knowledge of it as one piece in the toolkit and sort of explain the difference to us between chronic and acute inflammation. You know, one question we keep coming back to is, how do I know if I'm inflamed? You know, like I feel bloated sometimes. Is that inflammation? My muscles hurt after a workout for a long time. That's certainly inflammation. If I'm taking Advil after a workout for my delayed onset muscle soreness, am I doing a disservice to my gut? Like, inflammation is such a crazy loaded thing that seems to be the source of all evil, but we don't really know like what is motivating it necessarily. Can you help us with that?
Well, I mean, the only way you're going to absolutely be able to figure out where it's coming from is objective diagnostics. So, like, obviously, we have a blood marker, high sensitivity CRP, which is probably the best one we can use in the blood to determine that there is inflammation. But then I suppose it's looking at the source, and there are going to be a huge variety of sources that it can be coming from. But the gut is a big one. And again, the only way to identify what, like, okay, yeah, the main thing we're talking about, I didn't even talk about what can be going wrong in the gut. So a dysbiosis ultimately is what you're looking at there. So is there an imbalance in the microorganisms in the gut? For most people, there's pathogens present, and that's the real thing that you want to look at on a stool test. I don't think the literature is at a point whereby you can look at all of the bacteria within the microbiome and say, this is what it's supposed to look like. And I really don't think it's there. Maybe with ratios of one to another, we can see that they're linked to X, Y, and Z. We're not really at the level where you're manipulating other microbiomes. And again, other different populations probably have different microbiome signatures as well. But pathogens is what you want to look at. So are there any pathogenic bacteria, any fungal overgrowth, parasites in particular, or worms? The other thing to bear in mind on a stool test would be enzymes, like how we break the food down into smaller pieces does play a huge role later down in the gut. And that's a big thing for many people.
There was an article in the New York Times on this side of the ocean last week or the week before around long COVID and how they've found that there's actually a connection to long COVID in the gut. So the pathogens exist in the gut and they're prohibiting dopamine or serotonin. Like there's a relationship to the COVID in the gut and your ability to produce serotonin and dopamine. And that's what's leading to brain fog. And so now that they've uncovered that, there are, you know, all these like positive implications to figuring out how to figure out long COVID. But, you know, perimenopause feels like long COVID sometimes, you know, with the brain fog and all the rest of it. So I'm starting to put these pieces together. Like, you know, if I've got pathogens, like any kind of pathogens, whether it's, what is it, flu, something I ate on, you know, in Mexico when I was 23 on spring break with, you know, in college, like what, like how
they're usually not acute parasites. So like if, let's say for example, you go to Mexico, you get a tummy bug, like that's an acute parasite, and that's rarely, I suppose, the source of all evils. However, it can leave you more susceptible by virtue of whatever treatment to take on board, obviously antibiotic stress and so on, can you leave you susceptible to dysbiosis. And even like if you look back at childhood, like that's when the microbiome is developing. So the huge role that childhood trauma plays, I suppose, in gut issues and menstrual complaints. But usually when we're talking about parasites or bacteria, they generally tend to be more low-grade chronic parasites that don't necessarily make somebody acutely unwell, and can be misleading in the sense that sometimes, let's say, if someone has a very poor diet, they have bloating, they have all sorts of problems, and they think, oh, you know what, like I read this article, I need to look after my gut, so I'm going to change my diet. Once they change to a relatively diet low in processed foods, they may notice symptomatic improvement. And so then they don't go down the route of investigations. And yeah, they will notice some symptomatic improvement, but inevitably down the line, those symptoms will come back. So just changing the diet alone is not going to fix those types of pathogens. So things like blastocystis, dientamoeba, and then fungal organisms and bacteria, Citrobacter is a big one.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're okay.
So there's some of the moms here. What can we be doing for our kids now to set them up for good gut health? And then let's talk about some of the proactive things we can be doing for our gut. And then, I mean, I don't know if anybody else feels the extreme need to poop in a jar and send it off in the mail somewhere right now, but I'm very excited about that now. I don't know where I should send my poop, but like, I really, really want to.
It's such an important test to do. It really is.
Yeah.
Because information is power. So if you know what's going on, it's a lot easier to address it. That being said, those type of things don't resolve overnight. If there is a parasite, oftentimes people think, oh, if I just take an antiparasitic medication, this is going to solve all my ills. That's not the case either, because there's going to be a lot of work that needs to go follow from taking a medication, if that's what's needed. Now, the good thing about stool tests as well is they will do what's called a sensitivity test. So that means that they're going to test the microorganism. Now, it doesn't pertain to the parasites, only just bacteria and fungal organisms, but it will do a sensitivity test in the lab, which means they grow the microorganism for the sake of argument, and they test it against the pharmaceutical antibiotics. As well as nutraceutical compounds, so things like berberine, uvaerce, oregano oil, garlic, these sorts of things. So you will know if you can go with the more nutraceutical approach versus the pharmaceutical avenue. None of them come without side effects, but they're certainly more minimal, let's say, with the nutraceuticals.
Just bad breath if you're like dosing on garlic to get rid of your bad bacteria in your gut.
Yeah, exactly. There's little things like that. Now, look, with garlic, I would generally just say to ramp it up in the food for most people if they like it, rather than taking like an Allicin supplement as such. But
I'm starting to understand why my partner never gets sick, because I think he has a really, I think my hypothesis is that he has a great gut, and he's like a real garlic fiend and does a lot of great cooking. So there might be a correlation there that is
very possibly.
Yeah. Okay. So for our kids though, what I heard is processed foods are not great for your gut. Mm-mm. What is great for our gut? What should our kids be eating? What should we be eating proactively, just at least to give us time before we get our stool sample results?
Okay, well, the food is going to be important. And certainly, like, the easiest approach to take is to reduce eliminate entirely processed foods. You know, I think that's an easy route to follow for most people. So if it's in a packet, it's probably not good for you. To stick to things like meat, depending on where you live, meat, fish, eggs, nuts, seeds, fruits, vegetables. This is a good way to look at that. Should be the vast majority of the food that you take in. With kids, it's very difficult. So, you know, like kids go to parties, and sometimes the stress that's involved on both the parents and the child by trying to adhere to an entirely non-processed diet is probably negating the benefit of eating the right food, because we know that stress is probably the biggest thing aside from food that's going to manipulate the microbiome, especially in the early years of life. So there are so many studies around the role of childhood maltreatment and abuse and disruptions within the microbiome that then leads the children to susceptible to mental illness down the line. And that's amazing research if anybody wants to have a look at it. But
Broadly, not just like gastrointestinal trauma. It's like broad trauma creates so much stress for a little guy that they get all bound up down there. And that can even lead to terrible PMS down the road and, you know, all sorts of other things sort of as we age.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm talking mainly about like abuse and stuff in childhood.
Okay.
But again, like that's a fairly broad term, like childhood maltreatment, abuse, you know, and I suppose each child is going to be more susceptible to different things that happen. So I suppose I'm using that as an example to demonstrate the role of stress on the microbiome and the implications of that later on in life. The other good things I think for kids is to be mindful of like having pets. Like if we look at any of the literature around the microbiome, having pets is always top there. Being in nature, not being overly conscious with the Dettol sprays or disinfectant sprays. Those are simple things to do, you know, so you are getting exposed to positive environmental things like that. The other thing, I suppose, food. Then I suppose fasting is a nice lifestyle one to be mindful of. Now, fasting doesn't mean you're fasting for a week on end. But fasting, for one, you're looking at like the overnight fast and seeing how, like, you know, sometimes people eat right up to bedtime and then they eat first thing in the morning. But to try to have that big gap, at least 12 hours, I would say, between the evening meal and the first meal of the day. The other thing is gaps between meals during the day. So I think people have such a huge habit now of snacking in between meals. But for the gut, it is ideal to have nice rest periods in between meals. And that will differ depending on the person, how long those gaps are. But certainly for kids, it's a nice one to be mindful of.
We heard from one of our friends and experts, Stacey Sims, who we love, that for women in particular, you know, in our 40s and 50s, it's important to break our fast in the morning because of the implications on our cortisol level and how we're managing so much stress cortisol. And what I'm hearing from you is correlated, because if I finish eating at 7 at night, which is a positive time to stop eating a couple hours before I go to bed, and then I wake up and have it at 7 a.m., I'm not intermittent fasting. I've had a fast, like a normal fast, and I'm still managing my cortisol in the morning with a little collagen or something else, right?
Yeah, and I think sometimes people think of fasting as like big 24, 48 hours fast, but that's not, I suppose, really what I'm referring to. It's to make sure that you are having some gap at nighttime for both kids. And fasting is going to be person dependent as well. So not everybody is going to be able to cope as well as somebody else.
Yeah.
Like things like someone's on insulin and stuff like that, you have to be very careful. But then there is also, I suppose, from a gut perspective, the option of a fasting mimicking approach, whereby you're not having, like, you're kind of mimicking a fast effectively. And that is quite good literature on it, I suppose, not only for the gut, because you can see quick shifts in the microbiome, even in 24 hours of a fast. The fasting mimicking approach is where, like, you might, like, I sometimes just say to people, just take bone broth, because at least you're getting so many nutrients in that, and you're still getting some calories, but you're keeping the gut at a nice resting phase to allow for those microbial shifts, to promote diversity and so on.
Is that something good to do, like as a protocol? Like say I go on, you know, Christmas holidays with my family and we don't have a lot of control of what we're eating out a lot, come back, do bone broth for a day and start to give myself a jump start on my microbiome getting back on track?
Yeah, I think it's nice for people to do that every 3-4 months. Yeah, it's always a nice little reset. Especially, like you said, after holidays or after the summer break or after a period. And look, it's also nice as well for people. Let's say they have been on a very rigid diet, because, you know, in a perfect world, we would all just eat like non-processed foods all the time. But that's not realistic. There has to be some leeway for being able to enjoy X, Y, and Z whenever we're on holidays or whatever happens to be. And so the fast, like the duration of that fast will depend on what your baseline is. So let's say you've done, for example, if someone has a stool test and I've done the interventions with them from an antimicrobial or antiparasitic medication, then I might get them to do a 5-day fast or fasting mimicking diet with like a medical food, bone broth, depending on the person and how well they're going to tolerate lower calories. But then down the line, even 2-3 days of the fasting mimicking approach or a 24-hour water fast, if they're able for that, can be really helpful just as a reset, not only just for the microbial side of things, but also like to limit any of those inflammatory reactions that may have resulted from having food that you wouldn't normally eat, not just the foods that you wouldn't normally eat, but the volume of food that you might normally eat. And with that in mind, I suppose as we are coming up to, you guys have Thanksgiving and Christmas and so on, but oftentimes around those periods, it's no harm to have an enzyme, a digestive enzyme complex at hand. Like you said, not only because of the foods that you wouldn't normally eat, but the volume of food tends to be much higher around those periods. So taking an enzyme could just help minimize any potential GI distress or problems that might result from that immediate change in the food. And maybe to ramp up the dose of the fish oils, because again, you're looking at the postprandial inflammatory load, and the fish oil omega-3 can help really well with that to minimize things like brain fog the next day. It's not going to totally eliminate it, but it certainly helps.
So I'm hearing a lot of fish oils. I'm hearing digestive enzymes. How do you feel about creatine?
Creatine for the brain or
for the gut? We heard creatine's a good thing for us as we age, because our creatine levels decrease naturally in perimenopause, and that's something that's helpful for the gut-brain connection.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're not eating a lot of meat or fish, then yeah, there's no harm to taking a 5-gram dose a day.
Yeah.
2.5 grams after maybe our loading phase. But I suppose the goal, like, because a lot of people are taking a lot of supplements. So the goal is to get as much of our nutrients from whole food sources and then supplementing what we do or don't need. Because remember, like, supplements aren't just the nutrients, like there's other things in them as well. So you do kind of want to be mindful of those aspects too.
Well, I've heard you mention multiple times, and I want to just ring the bell. You weight train, because you know that like how powerful a connection that has for all of our body systems. You want to give us any sort of public service announcement on strength training as women?
Where to start?
For anybody who's just listening to this, I made Dr. Fanola blush. Weight training is what we all need to do. Yes. Okay, if you have a specific digestive enzyme that you love,
you know what? Like, I really like the Easy 14. I can't remember what it's Easy 14 or Easy 12. I can never remember. I think it's 14. You see it over there. You can get it in the US.
Okay.
It's actually Eric Serrano makes it or designed it.
Okay.
Easy that would be my favorite one.
When we're in a place where we're sort of consciously doing gut damage, like holidays or, you know, spring break or whatever it may be.
Yeah. Now look, other people, I suppose that's the other thing you're going to see on a stool test is whether you need enzyme supplementation or not. So some people might be on it anyways, addressing some of those issues. But yeah, certainly it's a nice one to have in the toolkit for damage limitation, as I say, around those periods.
How do you feel about probiotics? Is that a racket or is that real?
I think it's important to have a good idea of what's going on first before you just go taking a probiotic.
That's great.
I think prebiotics may be a bit of a better approach initially if you don't have a test. And best of all, prebiotic foods. You know, if you think you've no pathogens in the gut, just stick to prebiotic foods. Sauerkraut, kimchi, kombucha, all these types of prebiotic foods, the resistant starches, they're all going to be helpful foods without taking a supplement. Because we know how important these bacteria are, not just the bacteria itself, but the balance of them. And equally, as with everything in the body, it's a fine balance that's optimal. Too much is not always better. You know, it's like even with sometimes supplements, people say, oh, I heard this is good. So they take loads of it and then you end up seeing problems as a result. Like sometimes people take probiotics and they're 10 times worse in terms of the gut, because you don't know what's going on. Do they have what's grown in there? Especially if you have symptoms, I wouldn't be taking them.
Yeah. You know what is particularly annoying about being 45, you know, as an example, I just turned 45, you know, there's this complexity of life right now. You know, I have young kids, I have a job, I have a teenager, my parents are old, like there's just a lot coming at me. And then the idea of trying to eat more diversity for my gut and also weight train and also like figure out the right supplementation, it can feel very overwhelming. And so I understand the reaction to just have a quick fix or to decomplicate things, to just, you know, feel good in my body for a day, you know? And so, you know, with all that said, are there any hacks just, you know, so we can meet people where they're listening? You know, I like, can I eat sauerkraut every day, or should I do sauerkraut and kimchi and kombucha and lick my floor every now and again, just to get my dog's bacteria? Like what's the hack? Fiona, Finola met my dog on our last pre-chat, and Finola talks to you. So maybe that's actually the homework for everybody to see.
I think the best thing people could do for their gut is really just to minimize the processed foods. If people could just stick with that one thing, I think that will make the biggest difference. You know, I think that's it's the simplest thing, but probably the most potent thing, realistically. Yeah. And managing, look, I mean, stress is not the easiest thing to manage anyways, but I suppose having something that you can do that's really quick. I know for me, like, I like using the apps, you know, the CAM apps, that you can do 5-minute sessions wherever you are. If you just in that moment feel like you need a breather, because if we keep letting ourselves go up and up and up in terms of anxiety and stress, you get used to that. You know, people become accustomed to that level of stress, and it's very hard for them to come out of that because they're so, they often becomes addictive to be in that level of stress and anxiety. So it helps you recognize that you can't make decisions accurately when you are up at that level.
It's so true. Another thing I like is really just an intentional tantrum. So I'll just let myself have a freak out moment and I'll scream. And you know what? I invite everyone listening to do a primal scream later, whether it's into a pillow or you go into the woods and scream. I promise you'll feel better. There's a reason kids have tantrums. You let all the it out and then you're not carrying it around. And there's a lot to learn from that.
I'm crying, you know?
Oh, I love to cry.
Yeah, in this day and age, it's often perceived as something that you should not do, or, oh, if, you know, a lot of people start crying, like, I'll see it in your consults, and they say, oh, I'm sorry. Like, crying is good. Like, it's there for a reason. It's a natural physiological response to purge whatever emotion is you're feeling. Like, I would say crying is good, because at least you're feeling something. It's more worrying if you don't feel anything. Now, that is a real problem. So if you're crying and your body is making you cry, then let yourself cry. Go with it. You'll feel a million times better afterwards.
So great. I know, I wish there was, and I mean, I don't really wish there was a pill, because that would probably mess with our microbiome, but I do wish there was a magic wand that you could wave to just cry all your tears out when you need to, you know, and then move on, right? Like, that would be such a powerful tool to have. But there is The Notebook, which is a very popular movie, and that it's very sad. So I offer that, or
I've actually never seen that.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
What a heart. I know.
I think I saw it in my 20s, and I couldn't contain myself for like 3 blocks after the movie theater. I was living in New York City. I was still like actively sobbing. So yeah. Anyway, maybe everybody's homework for the weekend is rent The Notebook.
Sounds good.
Yeah. This is also good. We're going to open it up for questions in just one more minute. But I mean, from the, we touched on this early, but I just want to like put a bottom line on it, put a pin in it. Like, really, what happens for women in perimenopause is our hormones fall off a cliff. And so to understand the relationship between our gut and estrogen, and what you were saying was estrogen processing, is it that our estrogen falls off a cliff and then it messes with our gut? Or is that our gut gets to a certain point that it starts to mess with our estrogen, and that's what helps it sort of have that precipitous fall?
Well, it's a two-way street. So like, we know that it's not just estrogen. Progesterone also, we've seen in the literature, particularly in pregnancy studies, I suppose it's a nice model that they've used, that progesterone has an impact on the bifidobacterium. So when the progesterone peaks during pregnancy, bifidobacteria grow growth goes up. So I suppose it's hypothesized that when, you know, we reach the level where the hormones are declining, that there is going to be a negative impact. And you do see that on stool tests as well. And we know estrogen is also responsible for maintaining microbial diversity. So the sex hormones alone have an impact on the microbiome. But it is, like I said, a bi-directional street. So if we, as I said earlier, we have all of these bugs in the gut, and then there's the subset called the estrobilum. So let's say, for example, we start out in the perimenopause and we have a mild dysbiosis. It's only going to get worse as the sex hormones decline, because they're kind of keeping us level, as it were, if everything's going well. And then all of a sudden they're starting to decline. So the positive impact of those on the microbiome is no longer there, I suppose. And then we're more likely to have problems with that enzyme we talked about before, the beta-glucuronidase. So that's an enzyme responsible for estrogen recirculation. So there's, I think most people talk about it being too high, but too low is not good either. And although having it high, if beta-glucuronidase is high in our menstrual life, if we have too much recirculation of estrogens, which should be going down the toilet, we end up with problems with the periods. And while that might sound like a good thing in menopause, recirculating estrogens back into the system, it's not, because what happens is it offsets the ratio with progesterone. So if that's already off, it's not going to get any better. So I suppose the fact of the matter is that we want to make sure that we have optimal gut before we get into the perimenopause, at which point it's very difficult to fix. Is that making sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying, but it is fixable once we're
It is fixable. That's the thing. Yeah. It is fixable. And, you know, it's simple things. Like I said, it's simple things that can help that, you know. And look, like I said, you can do it. The stool test shows your beta-glucuronidase as well. So doing the stool test, you can see all of this very objectively and go from there.
Where do we get the stool test? Like, I can't just poop into some Tupperware in my house and send it through the UPS. Is there any service that is either in North America or global that you recommend?
Yeah, I use Genova. So the test I would use is the GIFX Comprehensive Profile. Personally, I think that's the best one on the market. I mean, other people might have their own favorites, but I've used that for many years, and they've, I suppose, updated the test alongside the requirements. So like I said earlier, they've do both micro and PCR and the sensitivity test, which is nice. And there's also the beta-glucuronidase on the short, the metabolic byproducts. I like the short chain fatty acids. And that is in the US, as far as I know. Whether you can just order the tests in the absence of a physician, I don't know. You can't here, as far as I know, but I think in the US you possibly can.
And we're looking for either a functional medicine doctor, or is a gastroenterologist our next best bet?
They may. But what you can do is go on the Genova website. I know in the UK and Ireland anyways, they will have a section where you can go and look up if the what physician in your area is linked with the lab, because like you need to be able to interpret the test as well. Now, like you said, I have a feeling that in some states in the US, you can just order the test yourself and you don't need to go to any physician, but don't quote me on that.
Okay, great. We have some questions from the audience. Are we ready to...
Sure.
Okay.
I am.
Okay, perfect. Aoife has a question about indemnity. So she's a doctor in Ireland studying functional medicine and practicing in lifestyle medicine. It's so difficult to practice because neither is recognized as a specialty yet. Getting indemnity cover is almost impossible. Any advice? This is great.
Yeah, I can give you like my own insurance if you like, you know, if you want to make my email, like my own insurance company. it is difficult, yeah. You don't fall into any category, like in terms of like with the Irish Medical Council, when you renew the license, you don't really fall into any category.
Exactly.
So it's kind of
Sorry, there's Aoife. Go ahead.
Hi, Sunil. How are you? Thanks so much for this. I'm just the tail end of COVID, so excuse my even more dulcet Irish brogue. I've been really struggling. I'm so interested in this. I think I've been in touch with you a couple of years ago because it's something I've been studying. I've done a couple of the courses and a couple of the modules. But to be honest with you, because it's been so difficult to actually implemented, it's kind of put it on the back burner for me. And I have been practicing as a lifestyle medicine consultant, sort of tied in more with sort of health screening and Occhi Health type thing. That's the way I've had to kind of go around it, which is not what I want to be doing, because it ends up being a one-off sort of seeing someone, and it's not actually, you're not seeing the progress of people. You're not getting that sense of, okay, let's work together for a period of time. And as we all know, it's not a one-off kind of quick fix situation usually with these patients. And I've got people approaching me all the time, and it's that, even that thing of like, I don't even know what to tell them, because, you know, my indemnity, my background's in anesthetics and intensive care. My indemnity for practicing doing this, right, where I'm not prescribing anything, I'm not doing anything, they get blood tests, etc., is 10 times what it is to be an anesthetist.
I know. You want to email me maybe afterwards?
Yeah, great.
We'll connect you, Aoife, to Finola, and you all can. That's so kind, Finola. Really kind.
No problem, no. Yeah, I think I know the name. Patients. That's why I'm thinking. I think I've been speaking with you before.
Yeah. I think I am. Yeah, send a message maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, so give me an email.
Thanks a million, guys. And great to see so many of you on here as well.
Super cool. And we have another question. So Cynthia has to send in a poop test for cancer. We're so sorry, Cynthia. I hope everything's okay. Or sorry, it's Deanna, sorry, is over 60 and sending in a poop test for cancer. Will they test for other things when they're looking at, I'll call it a stool test. Sorry, I'll be more clinical for her, in her stool. Will they look for other things?
If it's acute hospital tests, no, usually not.
Okay. So maybe Deanna, if you're interested in more, maybe there's a way to supersize the panel or...
Yeah, like I don't know if the lady's in the UK or Ireland or the US.
London, Ontario, Canada. So a whole other
Canada, yeah, okay. Canada, they probably won't do it in the hospital. But what you can do is go onto the Genova website and you can download the sample report of the stool test. And you can ask whoever is doing the stool test, you're already taking the samples, if it's possible for the lab that they're sending it to in the hospital, presumably, if they can run some of those markers. They may or may not, but at least you have the markers there in that report of what would be nice to see.
That's great. Cynthia has a question. Deanna says, thank you. Thank you, Deanna. Good luck. We're rooting for you. We are. Cynthia says, I'm really good about eating whole foods with plenty of vegetables and fruit that's measured and weighed for each meal. I'm conscious about drinking water. However, I have issues with constipation without the regular use of magnesium. Any suggestions? I'm 61. I hear you, Cynthia. I've been on magnesium, I think, since my 30s. And up until that point, I don't think I pooped once a week.
Yeah, I mean, constipation's a funny one. So like, it's a good idea to maybe think of the whole picture. I think I would, if you're 60, I'll be looking at doing a test if it's been going on for many years, rather than, you know, a lot of people with constipation go straight in with fiber or increased fiber. And sometimes that can be a recipe for disaster in the 10 times worse. Some people might need to reduce the fiber, water intake. Then some people take too much water, but they don't take enough salt, and all of those affect motility. But I think the biggest thing I would encourage you to do is to get the test and see what's going on. Enzyme might be an issue with enzymes as well. So there's a whole host of things that could be affecting constipation, not to mention the psychological, the role of the brain as well, something that unfortunately we can't do an objective test for. So being mindful of things like stress management, yoga, all of these things are equally as important as supplementation and food.
My three-year-old was potty training and she got constipated. She like ate all the cheese off a cheese board one night. We were having a cocktail party and not much else, and she got really constipated, and then it just kind of tricked her brain. And now she's afraid of pooping. And now this is, I just want to create some empathy for this whole community, because I need you guys, your loving kindness. Now she swims at school, and every time she gets in the pool at school, she's so relaxed, she poops. Because it's this wonderful thing. And that, and, but you know, her swim diaper wasn't, you know, tight enough. Anyway, it got poop in the school. They had to shut down the pool and come out. And this three-year-old now is so super embarrassed and has all this trauma around poop. And then this week they wouldn't even let her go in the pool. And so then now, you know what I mean? Like, again, like it can start whenever it starts. And I don't know. I don't know that I'm looking for advice as much as, what do I do? Like my three-year-old has poop trauma already. Like, can she get back on the road?
I think I would just let it settle down and not make too much of a fuss would be my thoughts on it initially, because the more like it's made a big deal of, the worse it's going to be for a child.
Yeah.
So I would try to see it as it settled down. And then look, there's always the option of a psychologist if it's really becoming a problem, you know, like try a psychologist. Play therapy is what it's called.
What therapy?
Play therapy for the children, isn't it?
Play. Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. Thank you for that. And thank
because
you.
Because it is, it's just like, if she's pooping in the pill, it's not like she has urgency, I would imagine. Like,
no.
It's not like, you know, like she's has a local digestive issue, I would say, or a local GI issue. It sounds more like a psychological issue.
Yeah, she holds it. She holds it, definitely.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she had that one time where she pooped and it was really painful. And so now she remembers that unconsciously, really.
It's still very hard.
No. She, it looks good. I like the look of it. Not hard. Yeah.
Maybe try.
I'm into a lot of poop here in our household.
Well, that's good. That's what you should be doing. You know, I can't tell you how many people, you ask them what their poop looks like and they have no idea. I don't know.
Don't you think a pool, like, okay, what do you think about this big business idea? A poop tracker where you could take a picture of your poop and it would, through AI, it would give you some information just about like the quality of your poop from the visual.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And also have your food diary incorporated into the app, so you can see the response of the stool to changes in the food, for example. And you might also be able to track transit time and stuff like that, which would be just...
Oh, yes. Okay. If anybody
because that's another important thing as well, because, you know, sometimes like looking at how long does it take for the food that you eat in the mouth to go down the toilet, that's a really important part of digestive health as well.
How long should it take?
Well, it depends on the food as well, but like you want to be clearing things out every 24 hours at least.
Okay. What are your thoughts on the ketogenic diet, and is it suitable for women 40 plus who are experiencing menopause?
I would discourage it for a variety of reasons for the menopause. Look, the ketogenic diet is a very rigid diet to follow. And the only circumstances where it would be medically advised, I suppose, or let's say recommended, would be in extreme cases. So things like severe depression, severe anxiety, for certain people, depending on the underlying pathology that's there. So like a dopaminergic type depression, anxiety, ketogenic can be infinitely therapeutic for someone who has both of those going on, or epilepsy obviously is the other big one. While the ketogenic diet might sound like a great idea because it's low carbohydrates and high in fat, I think if someone is keen on it, I would be looking at a cyclic approach. So maybe let's say 2 days a week there's no carbohydrates, third day add in some carbohydrates, so it's this a cyclic approach. But I think pure ketogenic diet or pure carnivore approach is probably a little bit extreme, just even from a psychological perspective. I don't think it's going to do any harm to someone in menopause, but I think it's very extreme to be recommending to someone deliberately unless they have extreme symptoms.
What's your point of view on, so we hear the easiest thing we can do is limit processed foods. What's your point of view, like, is all grain processed because it has to go through the mill and it comes in a package? Like, should we be abstaining from all grains? Like, if I made cookies at home and it technically wasn't out of a package, but my sugar's out of a package, my flour's out of a package, the butter's out of a package.
Yeah. Like, I think if you want to make those things at home, it's not as bad as, let's say, buying them made up, like cookies, for example. Mm-hmm. But I would class those as processed, yeah.
Yeah, so honest. Anything in a package. Butter, too?
Well, like, butter is going to come in a package anyways. You know, but I don't think that's probably the worst thing you could be having. Like, obviously, margarine, or I don't know what else you have in the US, but, like, I personally don't like butter. I have a phobia of it, so... put it that way.
A butter phobia. That sounds like a whole...
Oh, I can't have it anywhere near me. Like, I can't, even at dinner, like, if it's on the table, I wouldn't be able to eat.
Do you have any idea where that comes from?
Ever since I was a kid, I've had it. Ever since. I don't ever remember being able
Lisa
to.
Has a butter phobia, too. Oh, people have to form a support group. I would be on the other side. What is it when you're extremely pro butter? I don't know. Maybe
a butter fetish.
A butter fetish. Yeah, I'm not quite there. Oh, Eva says an Irish mammy probably gave it to you on a spoon, and that's what ruined it for you for life. Oh God. You're sick. Oh, okay. So that's really poignant, right? Like we think about processed foods, like the garbage that we're getting, you know, in a package at the grocery store, but then there's also these component parts that make up a lot of the foods that we're eating, and that's technically processed too. So if we can recognize the food and we can sort of have a one-step process to what it looked like either in the ground or on the animal, it's, you know, the better, right? The less steps it gets to us and it's in what it looks like.
Yeah, and then I suppose I'm going a bit further than that. I suppose it is super important around a perimenopause, menopause period to make sure that there's enough fat, like that you are eating fat, because inevitably, I suppose, as we age, we're all going to put on a little bit of extra weight. That's sort of like the certain amount we can't really get past, like unless you take extreme measures. But, you know, the weight goes on, and obviously too much weight is not ideal, and you should be mindful of that. But it can be a fear thing as well, that oftentimes women in that period, like, okay, I'm putting out all the fatty foods, and that is not going to be good for like a variety of reasons. It's not going to be good because of how much it affects hormonal metabolism, and for the brain, which like is the biggest organ that can be affected and cause as much most of stress as anything. So not to go low fat during the perimenopause. So if you're having beef, like it's a ribeye steak, not a lean fillet steak, you know, or if you have like picking lamb or chicken, like if you're having chicken, eat the legs or the thighs with the skin on it. That's the best part and the tastiest part.
The best part. It's really the best part.
You know?
Well, so help me understand too, because so there's all these, like, you know, we're eating all these fruits and vegetables, all these things, you know, and I think part of, you know, what holds this community together is the lack of resignation about going calmly into, you know, aging like our parents did. You know, we don't want to be resigned to what previously has been inevitable. So when I hear a little bit of weight gain is inevitable, I'm a little afraid of that. And I guess I wonder, like, you know, how do we hold like a beautiful relationship to our aging bodies without being resigned to, I don't know, the impact of it or the, you know.
Yeah, no, when I say a little bit of weight, like I'm not talking like 5 kilos. I mean, and the shape of the body can change a little bit, you know, that's not unusual, but there's lots that we can do to minimize it. And I would strongly encourage that. So like things like the resistance training, as you mentioned earlier, that can have a massive impact. And look, sometimes recommendations like this for the weight are the best ones to be looking at, because they're the easiest one. They're the most likely ones that people are going to take on board, because the weight is a big thing for most women. Now, the other thing, since you're talking about the gut, which I didn't actually touch on, was the role of the gut in terms of insulin sensitivity. So we know from the literature, in the past, we used to have what's called the glycemic load or the glycemic index. And most people would be familiar with what that means. So everybody that eats this piece of bread, the blood sugar goes up by this amount, and it's the same for everybody. That was the original concept. But what we know now is that's not really the case. And what makes the difference in terms of how much the blood sugar goes up after we've had a meal postprandial glucose response is determined by the balance of the microorganisms in the gut. So if we have a dysbiosis, we're more likely to run into problems with high blood sugar and insulin sensitivity, which we're already going to be more susceptible to as we reach the menopause, thus impacting further the weight gain. So another reason to be addressing the gut side of things. Now that can be a factor, the role of the gut on weight, on fat storage. That can be a problem in earlier years of life as well, but more pertinent, I suppose, around the menopause.
Yeah, it's interesting. What's your point of view on the continuous glucose monitors?
I think I try to avoid too much
noise.
Yeah, sometimes people get very obsessive with these things, and that can throw everything off. You know, sometimes people, like, nowadays there's all this monitoring, like, you know, monitoring this and these watches. Like, I don't have one because it would drive me mad. I would be one of those people that would be too into it. Look, if someone's able to do it, like, the once off or whatever, that's fine. But I think the more that we obsess over these things, the worse sometimes it can be.
Yeah, fair enough.
Especially the female body, it fluctuates all the time. So, like, not just, I suppose, a continuous glucose monitor, but all sorts of things, like even monitoring the weight, it can really have a negative impact on psychology. So I think if you're able to deal with those things, okay. But I think,
so you don't recommend weighing ourselves every day? We had another expert who sort of had a, you know, was so perturbed by the weight that she was gaining during perimenopause, she was waking up in the middle of the night and weighing herself. And certainly that's one extreme. How do we sort of look after what's happening with equanimity? You know, like, you know, I'll speak for myself. I'm having like a weird relationship to weighing myself these days, because part of me really doesn't want to care. You know, I care about a lot of other things. And then part of me really fucking cares that I weigh 5 pounds more than I did 6 months ago.
I can't answer that. I think, like, no, I mean, like,
are
no,
you
I think
a psychologist or a doctor?
Because that's like a body image And psychologists will say, like, some people say, oh yeah, I love yourself, whatever size, but that's not realistic. Like, you know, I'm speaking like for myself anyways, like not for everybody, but like, you know, like if you put on weight, you don't feel yourself for the most part, you know? And I think that's more of a, therapist side of things. So I don't think,
well, we do have our favorite therapist, Julie, coming back in November. So please check out hysterical.com and we can have all of those hard hitting self-love questions with Julie. All come back for Julie. You'll love her. Okay. I have some more gut questions. Sorry to digress with my psychosis. Julia actually asked, no, I know everybody relates. So, you know, what is really powerful about this community is that we have just free space to share what we're sharing. And that's what happens for these questions and with our experts. So it's just, I mean, there's a lot to be grateful for in this community. Julie asked, what type or combination of magnesium is positive for our gut?
Depends what you need, ultimately. I suppose the biggest thing that you want to look at is not some, like, the magnesium comes in different forms, like, so different forms going to exert different effects. If you're looking for a laxative effect, magnesium oxide is going to probably be the most potent, but again, you kind of want to avoid relying on the magnesium as a laxative effect. In terms of magnesium, there's different forms that you can use to elicit different effects. So like glycine, for example, or threonate, these are more calming chelates. And then there's the sprays. The sprays can be really good as well for someone who maybe doesn't want a massive laxative effect either. So I think it depends on the person.
Depends on what you need, right?
I said trying to not rely on the magnesium as laxatives, because I see a lot of that, to be honest.
Mm. Can you tell us about leaky gut and how do you know when you've got to the point where you have it fixed?
Again, that's testing as well, but I suppose a good indicator of how well it has yield ultimately is symptomatic improvement. So usually people with leaky gut will have symptoms, not only, I suppose, GI, but also brain symptoms. So like brain fog, low energy, low mental endurance, and so on, and oftentimes poor mood. But I suppose the biggest indicator of improvement in the absence of testing would be improvement in those symptoms. So look, testing is expensive. That's another point to make. So oftentimes when we're looking at subjective symptoms, I always think it's a good idea for people to keep a little journal, and not every day, but let's say once a month or even once a week, if you're in the early phases, check in and have the different things that you want to look at. So energy, mood, bloating, bowel habit, and just 1 out of 1 to 10, where do you feel you are? So at least then you go back and think, oh God, yeah, back then, like, it was pretty bad, because oftentimes people don't see you know, things are gradual. It's not like, oh, the next day I wake up and I'm perfect. So it's nice for people to feel like, or to be able to stay on track with things once they do see that things have improved, when they're looking at their own scales in the absence of testing, which is the gold standard.
There's I don't think it's new, but Clue, CLUE, is a perimenopause tracking app. For anybody who, yeah, wants to use that. What's your point of view on HRT?
Yeah, I think, like, but I mean, are we talking about bioidentical forms or?
Any real form, like, you know, if we think about the 34 symptoms correlated to perimenopause, and then, you know, how many are helped with, you know, estrogen supplementation, progesterone or testosterone supplementation. There's, you know, an incredible case to be made for doing that early, as we've heard from many, many experts. But what I'm also sort of picking up from you is also early, we really need to understand what's happening in our gut, maybe before we start with HRT or...
Yeah, look, it depends. It's going to depend on, I feel like I'm saying it depends on the person so often, but ultimately does. I suppose it depends how symptomatic the person is. And do they have any other comorbidities? So HRT, yeah, absolutely. If the person needs it, and look, it feels so much better once they do take it. The key to it is making sure that you're doing testing, you're keeping an eye on what's going on, and you're taking what you need. Like, not every woman is going to need a little bit of testosterone. Not maybe initially they don't need both estrogen and progesterone, just a little bit of progesterone initially can help. So to make sure that it is individualized in a sense, rather than just everybody take the Premarin and that's it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because that's where you run into side effects. The other thing I really would like to highlight the importance of, is that this is like late in the day for me, if I'm slow with the words, is the importance, I suppose, of having the gut optimized for when we're taking HRT, because like how we're processing the hormones, the exogenous hormones, is going to be affected by the liver and the gut. So if I'm taking these hormones and like I still have an issue with the gut, I'm just kind of masking it with the hormones, then you're more likely to run into side effects. You're more likely to need a higher dose, which again makes you more prone to side effects, and the balance won't be as optimal. So let's say you have some issue with the beta-glucuronidase. How is that being processed once it's getting to the gut and so on? So I would encourage anybody who is, even if you're already on HRT, it's still a good time to be doing it. But if you do, to make sure that you're testing, to make sure that there isn't any change in the bloods in response to the gut work you've done. So like, even if we look at women who do have a regular, or let's say they come because they have an irregular cycle, the cycle will change a little bit, which you want, once you do manipulation with the gut. There will be, so some of them, if they don't have period at all, it will come back. So the same applies for once we are taking exogenous hormones, to make sure that if we do work around the gut, that then we retest maybe 2 months down the line to see where things are at that point.
Clear.
And also not to forget like other supplements as well. So a good multi-nutrient is always worth taking, to again, to make sure, first of all, to support your body as it is, but also to ensure that the metabolism of those hormones is optimized.
Okay, so that actually leads to Deborah's question quite perfectly. Deborah asks, how can one simplify the overwhelming information on self-care and gut health? Should we prioritize key vitamins, and what are they, while handling the rest on a case-by-case basis, or is there a specific approach to managing daily supplements effectively? This is the truth. I have so much medicine in my cabinet, I really don't know what I'm doing. I feel the same way. I feel like every 3 years I throw out like $400 worth of supplements that I bought, you know, 4 years prior.
Well, look, I do the same thing as well at times, so I can totally relate. But ultimately, the gold standard is testing. And then I suppose short of that, I would avoid taking, if you don't have testing, avoid individual nutrients. Stick to like a really good multi-nutrient. Like in Ireland, we have Nutrient Advanced, they have excellent multi-nutrient complexes. I think in the US, you have Metagenics, which is the equivalent of Nutrient Advanced here. It is Metagenic still, isn't it? Or Designs for Health, Torn, those brands have excellent multi-nutrients. And magnesium. So multi-nutrient magnesium, a fish oil, and depending where in the world you are, an extra bit of vitamin D. You can't go wrong with that kind of basic supplement setup. If you're taking individual nutrients, you don't know if that's right for you. You don't know, is that the right form and so on. You can be doing more harm than good. So I would stick to a basic regimen rather than, you know, oh, this one and this. Like I said, we've all been there, but to try and keep it to a simple regimen.
How many individual is that vitamin D, right? Like that's something that
vitamin D is.
You're in Ireland, we need it.
Exactly. It's like dark here all day long.
Rashing rain and quite gray for 4 months out of the year. 2,000 IUs of vitamin D certainly help. We have seven more minutes. Is there anything like you wish I had asked, or that we asked, or that you want us to know? You've been so generous with your brain and your experience, but what's the big takeaway?
To look after yourself and to make yourself a priority, because I know, like, as women, we have so much shit going on, to use the language, that, like, it is so important to look after yourself and to take the time, regardless of what's going on, even if it's 5 minutes, you know, because what have you got if you don't look after yourself? Nothing. And then you have nothing if you don't have your health. You know, I know that all too well myself, you know.
Yeah. And do you feel like you're on the other side of it with your health journey? I mean, you've been through the ringer.
Absolutely. So that's why I keep going back to therapy, because it was the biggest thing that changed my life. It was no supplement. It was I did all the supplements and the diet stuff, but therapy was really what has made the difference in having a better life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good reminder. We do have two talk shows coming up in November, one with Dr. Julie Caldwell, who's a psychologist and who will give us a lot of tools for how to manage some things, both with and outside of our therapist's office. And then also an exercise with Suzanne Conrad around values. We learned from a therapist that we had on earlier this fall that if we are aligning our actions to our values, our current values, that is a great way to help support mental well-being and quell anxiety. So I'll just share that with this community. But Dr. Finola, we're so happy that you're a part of this community and what you're doing, and all the information you share, and how, just your generosity of spirit, we can feel it all over the world. So thank you for being here.
And thank you so much for having me, Amanda. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh my gosh. I think we'll see you again. I mean, I think maybe everybody who's on this call, go send your poop in, and then we'll have another follow-up call with Dr. Finola. We'll share all of our biomes and do a little bit of a rally around it.
Great idea. Because it's a lot easier maybe to understand your tests, like, and really relate it back to symptoms. If you have, let's say, a few people have reports, and even if anonymously you want to send in the symptoms, we can go through them. That's actually a great idea.
We're gonna have a poop rally. I'm very excited about it. You heard it.
3 days of poop.
Yeah. Okay. 3 days of poop. Okay. Everybody send your poops in, get your test back. We'll put it on the calendar. We'll follow up with Dr. Finola. We'll have a poop rally in the next couple of months, and then we're off to the races. Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Happy thinking wherever you are. See you soon.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.